I'm Chris Little and I work in the Development Progress Programme at ODI, and I'm here with Doreen Khoury from Hivos International. Doreen, what do you think are the primary challenges facing women in post-conflict and transitional settings?
I mean, I can talk very much about the Syrian context, and the challenge that they're facing in Syria is that before the uprising, which is now basically a civil war, was that the word women's rights and women's participation was very much a taboo subject, because the regime was very much allergic to anything that was rights, and anything to do with women in the social sphere was interpreted as charity. Mm-hmm. And what the revolution did was that it opened an enormous amount of space for new actors, including women, to do a lot of things. But at the same time, the challenges that they face is that while they are out there and they're active and they're fulfilling so many essential roles on the ground and on the international level, traditional gender roles, despite this opening, became very much entrenched, even more entrenched. Conservative values became more conservative. Traditions and customs, especially in rural areas, became even more entrenched. And so the challenge they face is that in this opening space, in this opening public space, how do they assert themselves? How do they keep up the momentum, assert themselves, and how do they deal with increasing conservatism on the ground? Because as you probably know, in Syria, what happened was that there was a big entrance, and now there's a big role for Al-Qaeda affiliates. And this has really changed things on the ground. And obviously, when this happens, the first victims are women. And so how do you balance these things together? How do we support women and keep their voices out there, keep them strong, but at the same time help them? Very difficult to fight, to keep going in this setting, because we there are so many examples of women who are leaders, and for instance in the liberated cities, but now are exiles. They've had to leave because they've challenged misogyny, they've challenged the cultural and traditions that have been imposed on them by Al-Qaeda affiliates. So I think for me that is the major challenge that they are facing. A second challenge they are facing is there is not enough solidarity. I would say not enough solidarity, not enough coverage, media coverage of these cases of women who are leaders in their communities. It's very much focused on the actors on the ground, the fighters, sorry, on the ground, and the military conflict, and portraying women as either refugees or victims of or people fleeing, but not as leaders and as actors. And there's a big number of women who are not just activists, but they've formed organizations, and they are being persecuted for it.
An ODI briefing paper on women's participation in peace and security has identified innovative ways in which women are asserting themselves in the public space. Are there any particularly striking examples you've come across in your work?
I mean, I think since 2011, what we have to sort of understand is that a public space and the space to be active and to do things really opened, because fear, I mean, the walls of fear broke down. And people suddenly, in general, I mean, civil society, especially young people, suddenly realized there's so much we can do in terms of resistance, in terms of peace building, in terms of a sort of defining citizenship, which is really important, defining national identity. And this was apart from the resistance, normal resistance activity. And what's happened since 2011, where we went from two or three very traditional women's organizations that had been operating for decades, to now we've got several women's magazines on women's issues out there. We've got radios, online radios led by women on women. And we've got, they might be not innovative in the Western sense, but in the Syrian context they are, because this never happened before. And I think that the speed in which they happened and the improving quality over the past 3 years is really something. And secondly, I think that even in the establishment of several humanitarian organizations led by women was really important, because they were more sensitized to a gender perspective on humanitarian aid, which is not, it's not just food, it's also reproductive health, sexual health of women. Thinking about this has been important, and also the setting up of shelters, addressing violence against women. For example, I can give several examples. For instance, one of the leaders of the main grassroots structures, the LCCs or the local coordination committees, Rafif Jouajati, one of the main things she did was to set up jasmine. They were called jasmine tents, and these were safe houses and safe spaces for women. In a country where it was, prior to 2011, it was really impossible to convince the regime to set up safe spaces for women. For example, women taking the lead in documenting human rights violations. And one great example is the Violence Documentation Center, which was set up by Razan Zaitouni. And unfortunately, she was abducted in August 2013. We know nothing about her. But these are some of the main, some of the striking examples. And also, a lot of women activists in Damascus were very creative in sort of manifesting resistance or silent resistance in a city that's very much still controlled by the regime, starting from 2011. And it wasn't just young men who took part in things like, for instance, all sorts of things like, for instance, painting the main river red to signify blood and violence, and also, for example, distributing fake identity, which has fake currency, which changes the face of Bashar and puts someone else or something. And women took young women activists took part in this, and they led it. I mean, one example I can give you, but she's no longer in Damascus, she's in Beirut now, so it's safe to say her name is Razan Ghazawi, and she's a prominent young woman who was very creative in resistance. And it's really very much breaking this kind of resistance sort of gets the guys, the people who are afraid, they're sitting on the fence, to get them on your side. So it's not innovative as in it's big and creative, but it's innovative in the Syrian context. This is what I always say. You're not going to find, wow, this is great, or look at this, look what they did. But it's groundbreaking in the Syrian context, because this stuff never happened. You never got any of this. And I'd also like to point out a feminist think tank, Syrian feminist think tank, which was set up in 2010. Their name is GRACA, it's G-R-A-C-A. And they have been really innovative in a lot of, they're now releasing YouTube videos which visualize and animate women's, they've taken certain women who have narratives and stories, either women prisoners or women who've been raped or women leaders, local leaders, and they've animated and visualized their stories through like 10-minute animations or 10-minute videos. And they've done a lot of stuff on breaking, on challenging gender roles in Syria. So that is one, I think, there's been a sort of a, I find it really astonishing that a country that I've always visited, I didn't realize how amazingly creative they've been, and how when, you know, these things break down, how you discover, wow, people are so creative and there's so much talent out there. And it's now they're free to express. So yeah, I think these are sort of main examples. There's lots out there.
Excellent. So what's one change that the international community needs to make to better support women in post-conflict and transitional settings?
International organizations, whether INGOs or foreign ministries, are not inclusive enough in the decision making. There's a huge amount of will to support Syrian women, whether on the ground, whether as peace builders, whether as peace negotiators, or getting their, giving them a role in the peace process. But there's, I don't see, so far, they're not treated as equals in terms of communication. Like, it's not participatory enough or inclusive enough. And it's happened, I mean, a lot of communication, they get missed out of a lot of communication and coordination. This is on a very practical level. And I think this needs to change. The problem is that many of the women leaders do not speak English. And this is a great big problem. There's a language barrier, and which means that emails are coming forth back and forth in English. They miss it. Sometimes they could read it, but they need to reply in Arabic. Or they reply in fractured English, and then they're demoralized and they don't take part. And I think that this is a key issue, is to have equal, open, transparent communication. Very difficult, because sometimes international organizations are very good at talking to each other and communicating with each other on something. Sometimes they're not very good at it. And a lot of the time, the actual target group, the actual person on the ground who's going to be do the stuff, like go to Geneva, do the peace negotiations, or work on peace building on the ground, they are left out. They're completely left out. And I've heard lots of complaints and lots of disillusionment on this. Also, to not always talk to the same people, always be open to looking at away from the people who are speak English, are articulate, are middle class, are sort of secular, and look at people who work in rural settings, for example, people who are on the ground, are in local leadership structures. Be more inclusive in how you who you work with, and not just rely on the same set of people who just, you know, go from place to place to place. And I think this is one of the main problems, is just this unwillingness or inability to think more inclusively. And also look at younger women. You know, it's a problem. No one looks at young women. No one wants to talk to young women. It's always like experience and age is more important. And a lot of young women are very much disconnected from this level of peace negotiations and peace process. And a lot of the women's organizations that are involved have a gender problem. They have an age problem, a generational problem. So, yeah, I think these are just three very practical sort of... I can't give you a big framework, but this is what I would say is, I think, for me, the three main problems at the moment.